The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. You know, 20 minutes after our appointed time is not bad. Good job, members.
Considering you kept us here all night.
Then we should have been on time.
We could have stayed here.
Next time we'll bring our sleeping bag.
Thank you for the bagel.
You're welcome. My staff did that.
I know.
They're great.
They are.
Been fantastic. We're going to take Senator Erison Rope's small bill while we're waiting for Senator Clark to come down. And I know we're not on TV, but if we're on audio and Senator Clark is listening, she knows that she's supposed to be on her way down. Senator Erickson Ropes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate you being here bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. I understand you had a late evening last night. We'll start you off with a real easy bill, I hope. This is a bill that has to do with military personnel and contracts that they're involved in while they're stationed here in Minnesota. And if they get called up quickly to serve overseas or help out with floods or snow plowing, they'll be able to get out of some of the contracts if they're going to be extended for a longer period of time. And I'm joined here today by Brian Bergson from the AG's office and Colonel Eric Olness, who's a member of the Minnesota National Guard. And we have House File 552 before you. I'm sorry, 532 before you. And I'll pause at this point and turn it over to any technical explanations that might be needed. Brian, would you like to do that?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Brian Bergson. I'm the Director of Communications and Legislative Affairs for the Attorney General's Office. This bill mimics the Federal Service Members Relief Act, formerly known as the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act, and it extends certain benefits to activated soldiers, allowing them to get out of service contracts, gym club memberships, and cell phone contracts. One of the things that was brought to light during the last year or so was we have had deployed soldiers who have been having to pay for a cell phone while they're deployed and even not even able to use the phone. And so also we've had soldiers deployed who have had health club memberships and were unable to break those contracts even though they were not able to use the health club contract. We have also had small business owners who have been deployed who have rental contracts with computers, with copy machines, and this bill would allow them to break those service contracts as well.
Ms. Bergstrom, can I ask you this? I know that we're trying to do something good here for soldiers. Are we creating an opportunity here for some discrimination of military personnel in some of these contracts?
Madam Chair, I guess I don't understand your question.
Do we have any specific kind of prohibitions that will prohibit people from somehow not being willing to enter into these type of or disallowing these type of service contracts for military personnel if we allow this by law? I mean, if one of our guardsmen or women show up to sign up for a cell phone contract, you know, could they or would they be denied? And if they were, is there, you know, would there be a cause of action?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Colonel Eric Olness, Department of Military Affairs. Specifically addressing your question, no, there's not protection in this bill that would do that. One of the things that we do as an agency, whenever a bill comes in, we look at it to see, would this bill do something that would just cause a business or people to say, we're not going to deal with the military audience? And as we look at this and with our experience, we see that most business members are good corporate citizens of Minnesota and they let people out. This is for that small percentage of businesses that hold the service member to the letter of the contract and not let them out. So truly, this really helps those service members in those cases, but we don't see the opportunity where the vast majority of businesses would take it or would not deliver those services to service members. So we don't see that as an issue in this case.
Colonel, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Colonel, under you're really young. Under current law, now, what's been happening to our servicemen and women who've been deployed in these instances? Have they been able to negotiate with the businesses to achieve this even without it being in law?
Madam Chair, what typically happens is that we will intercede on the service member's behalf if they have an issue with the business. A lot of times when the service member goes and shows the order, a lot of the businesses will just merely let them out because they are good citizens, good corporate citizens. In the cases where it becomes an issue, we will intercede on behalf of the service member and ask for them to help. And that's basically what we're doing, is we're asking for their assistance. And again, that will fix, again, majority of the cases. In some cases, particularly like the cell phone is one where the corporate will not allow the person to go. What the soldier will often do is give it to a family member to use in their absence. They'll pay the bills, and then they return. They'll keep the phone. And there's cases, too, where service members want to keep their cell phone number, so they'll give it to a parent or to some other family member to use, and then when they get back home, they'll take it back. So not every time do they want to cancel these agreements.
And then one final question is that this benefit then only goes to just the specifically named service member, not extended beyond the service member to other family members. Yes?
Madam Chair, there's a provision in here that deals with the cold weather rule. In terms of the cell phone contract, it's just the service member. But the cold weather rule also protects a service member's family from having utilities and heat shut off. That's the only case where the members' families would be affected.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, maybe it might be helpful to just describe how the federal law works and how it may or may not tie into this. The federal law was passed actually around World War II, and it was upheld by the United States Supreme Court, giving a favorable view towards the service member who set aside personal affairs for the service of the country. Basically, the rights kick in when the person goes on active duty. It doesn't matter whether you were drafted, whether you volunteered, however you went in. And for the members of the military, reserves, and the guard who get called up and get deployed, it appears that this would be helpful to them. These are basically agreements that were entered into before the individual went on active duty or were deployed. So if they had a cell phone, if they had they were renting someplace, they had membership before they were called up, they have a responsibility to pay that. But once they get the orders for deployment, then nothing happens automatically. You know, the individual has to assert the rights, and if they want to cancel their membership, if they want to do that, the federal law, and presumably this would then allow them to get out of that, because maybe some individuals actually are making far less on military active duty than they were making in their civilian job plus the part-time job that they had in reserves. This apparently would also apply to people who just go on active duty from Minnesota, but the federal law does provide some protection to the families. In fact, what often will happen is maybe a family, a spouse is on, say, a loan, and once for a car, as an example, and once the service member is called up to active duty or deployed, sometimes the loan agency will try to renegotiate the contract, and by doing that, the spouse will lose all the protections that the service member had. So I don't know whether this covers all those situations as well too, but the idea is that now if a service member enters into these contracts after deployment, after they go on active duty, they're not covered by the federal law and presumably would not be covered by this. I mean, then those are obligations that they had knowing full well that they're going into the service, and they can't get out of them at that time. So as to your question, you know, it's all speculative. If somebody's going to get called up, if somebody's going to go on active duty, you don't know. And so I don't know that there'd be much opportunity for discrimination because, you know, any one of them may or may not be called up, but it's only when it actually happens that, the laws would kick in, certainly the federal law and presumably some of these provisions too.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Betzel. It's always good to have somebody who has that history and knowledge. The committee. Any further questions for Senator Erickson Ropes or the witnesses? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Erickson Ropes. The first section of your bill, which line 1.7 through 1.11, has to do with, if I'm understanding this correctly, is this extending in Minnesota to businesses the same rights that are recognized under federal law, under the Service Member Civil Relief Act isn't something that I'm familiar. Is this the same thing as the Soldiers and Sailors? Okay. I guess that's the way I commonly knew it when I was in the Air Force. One of the other protections that's afforded under this act has to do with service of process, the inability to serve process to someone when they are on active duty. And so that you can't, for example, file a lawsuit or sue for divorce or something like that to, against someone when they're stationed overseas, which makes sense. You don't want, you know, if they can't be given normal notice because they're concerned about litigation and that type, or concerned about our safety, they can't be worrying about dealing with litigation. But I guess I'm wondering, in the normal course of being able to do business, and especially with respect to a person's spouse, how that might impact normal business relationships, and if that's something that you intended as the, or have you thought that through in proposing this litigation or this legislation as far as how it would affect litigation?
Senator Olson, are you thinking in an instance where the the spouse who's in service is gone, but the remaining spouse might be subject to some kind of litigation or lawsuit on their behalf? Or
no, I guess what I'm thinking, Madam Chair, is of a situation where a spouse owns a business, and it could be a very large business that is doing normal business transactions, and there might be ongoing legal matters involving that business. If that the spouse of someone who owns that business happens to be serving overseas, that's going to put all of that normal, those normal legal matters on hold. And is that really what we, what's intended? And is there a need or a reason to do that?
Senator Erickson Ropes?
Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I believe some of those issues that you're talking about are probably addressed in the Federal Protection Act. Because I know that they do, if you'll refer to your fact sheet there, bullet four says delay of all civil court actions such as bankruptcy, foreclosure, and other proceedings. So if the spouse was a partner in a home business with a service member, I believe the family and the spouse would have protection under the federal law.
Senator Foley? Get someone to go through the bill so we can...
Senator Erickson Ropes or Ms. Bergstrom or Colonel?
Sure.
Can one of you kind of just walk us through the different sections of the bill?
In section one, this just makes it apply to the business wholly owned by the service member of the federal law. Section two.
Madam Chair.
Yeah.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, and I recognize Mr. Bergstrom is not an attorney.
Yeah,
but just following up with some of the questions Sarah Olson had, I don't know what that means. If somebody wholly owns a business, I don't know what protections or provisions are going to apply here, and I would like some examples, and I don't know that there's anybody, is there anybody at the witness table can tell me what this is going to mean, and I'm quite familiar with the federal law on this one. I don't know what this does.
Madam Chair and Senator Betzel, I'm thinking of a landscaping company. A soldier owns a landscaping company, and they have a rental contract with Xerox copy machine. and they wholly own that business, and so they're going to be allowed to break the contract with the Xerox copy machine. But in order to do that, they have to wholly own the business themselves.
Madam Chair, Mr. Bergstrom, why wouldn't the federal law cover that right now?
Because it doesn't relate down to it's my understanding, Senator Betzel, and you're right, I'm not an attorney. It's my understanding that we have had soldiers in Minnesota who have not been able to break contracts with various services that relate to their business. And so I was a benefactor of the Soldiers and Sailors Relief Act when I was called up for Desert Storm and was allowed to break my rental contract, for example. But not owning a business, I had no experience in this area. But
Madam Chair, I would suggest that the Attorney General's office believes that this is an important issue. The Attorney General's office ought to be sending a lawyer who can answer some of these questions. I would like to have somebody from that office come to talk to me about this particular section before it gets to the floor for a vote. I'd like to know a little bit more. I'm familiar with this area. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that we've got the witnesses here who can explain it, and apparently this is an important issue for the Attorney General's office, but they should send a lawyer here to explain this to me.
So Section 1 of the bill, Senator Betzel?
I would like to know a little bit more about that. There may be other provisions I'd like to know about, but I would like to know something about that from somebody who is well-versed in this area.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, and Senator Erickson Ropes, just to kind of follow up on what Senator Betzel said, the concern I have with this section is it doesn't just relate to breaking contracts. There are lots of rights that have to do that a soldier is accorded under the Soldiers and Sailors or what's now called the Service Members Civil Relief Act. And they may or may not be we should contemplate whether it makes sense to extend all of those rights to businesses and kind of, as Senator Betzel is saying, without the whole thing right here in front of me, it's been a long time since I've looked at it. I just would like to have an opportunity to think of how that might impact the business world.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Senator Betzold and Senator Olson. We'll take that under advisement, and if we just proceed through the bill, please, perhaps we could lay it over at the end of this discussion, and we can get in touch with the AG's office and try to get someone over here to answer that question.
Well, let's get through the bill, and we can decide whether we send it to the floor, and you catch up with us in the meantime. Honestly, Senator Erickson Ropes, given how much time you spent trying to get this bill on the agenda, if you lay it over, it might never come back. So, okay. Senator Scheid?
Madam Chair, I don't know if Senator Erickson Ropes or if you mentioned that this bill had come through the Commerce Committee. I agree, however, with what Senator Betzold saying about Section 1. I thought that we had some explanation of it in Commerce as to the kinds of things that are included, but I don't think we saw Sections 501 to 596, which seems like that's probably a pretty lengthy list if all of that's filled. But otherwise, we looked at the contracts and discussed the commerce perspective.
Very good.
And that's what has seen that.
Everybody reaches.
Nobody's attached to that, I think, Madam Chair.
Yeah. All right, Section. I don't know what section we're on, Ms. Bergstrom. Please discontinue.
Madam Chair, can we have that cell phone turned off?
I think it's just
it's very unknown.
Unless they call back.
You have more power than you thought.
I'll go. I'll be happy to pick that up right in the hallway.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
Madam Chair, I see that Brian Wadsland has left the room, so he's probably contacting the AG's office about that.
Section 2.
Section 2 deals with the disconnection of utilities. Basically extends the cold weather rule year-round for the affected service member and their family. Section 3 deals with cancellation without penalty of the wireless contracts. Section 4 deals with cancellation of club service and membership travel contracts. Health club contracts, again, some of those contracts dealing with the small business, such as copying machines. And Section 4 just deals with enforcement by the Attorney General's Office and 8.31.
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, in the example that Mr. Bergstrom had given about a soldier who had a lawn contracting business, does this also give a way for the lawn contracting business to cancel contracts with its customers? You know, the people who have the lawns that want care?
Mr. Bergstrom?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, yes, it would allow them to be able to break those contracts with their clients or their customers.
And, Madam Chair,
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Bergstrom, do they not have that? Is that a new thing that we are proposing to do here?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, yes, but I would like to think that if a customer knew that their lawn service man was heading overseas, that it really wouldn't be a problem, but in some instances it potentially could be.
Has anybody moved the bill yet, Madam Chair?
Madam Chair,
Senator Betzel.
I think that last point made by Senator Higgins raises a whole bunch of issues. The whole idea of the federal law is to protect the rights of the service member, but I don't know that it was intended for a service member to now use it to maybe to be disadvantage of the service member's customers.
Colonel, what's the real implication of that currently?
Madam Chair, the implication now is where a service member who has self-employed business and he deploys or she deploys, many times those businesses just go into abeyance. They have them go inactive until they return. And if this, my presumption was on it that this would be a one way that they would be able to break the contract with the people they have services with. And I think what this does is it keeps them from having a number of lawsuits because they're already protected from, on the Service Members Relief Act, they're protected from any lawsuits while they are deployed. But if someone, if they had to break contact because of the deployment and the person went for a legal remedy, they would have the opportunity of having a number of legal actions awaiting them upon their return. And this would reduce that opportunity where they would be able to exit those contracts and the people would look for other services or hopefully return to that service member once they return from the deployment and then reinstitute their programs and contracts with them, whatever the type of business may be. And just to go a little bit further, as we look at extending this to businesses as well as the individual, if you are an individual, you may have very well got your cell phone contract through your business, and that's a cell phone that you use for your wholly owned business. And that's why I think the Attorney General's Office and the senators and representatives who brought this forward were looking at that to make sure that that service member and their family were not disadvantaged, or a service provider would come back and say, well, this isn't to you as an individual. We sold this to you as your business, and thus we're not going to let you out of the contract. It gives a little more broad coverage to that service member and their family as a wholly owned business that they could exit out so they can perform service for the country.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, this is raising many, many issues, because if the business could be wholly owned and incorporated, and the reason why a business is incorporated is, of course, to shield the liability from an individual. And I don't know that this the Service Member Civil Relief Act was intended for such a purpose. I'm not willing to support the bill with Section 1 in here until we get those issues resolved. I think that if it's a desire to move the bill out, I'm not satisfied to set it to the floor and have this sitting in here until we get answers on that. So,
Senator Betzel, the council has gone downstairs. We've got the United States Code, and she's going to try to get sections 501 to 596 to give the committee members sort of a cursory overview of what that all entails. So,
and again, Madam Chair, but I don't think that that's going. I don't think it applies to businesses. It applies to individual rights. So, as I say, I think this is a significant expansion, and it goes into areas that are, I don't believe, are contemplated by the federal law. And
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson Ropes, it seems as though the issue you're trying to address specifically has to do with long-term contracts and wanting for small, wholly-owned businesses to make sure that they're not bound by these long-term contracts. I think the problem I have, and I can't speak for Senator Betzold, but perhaps the concern Senator Betzold has, is that the Service Member Civil Relief Act has to do with a much broader scope of things than just contracts. I wonder if there would be a way to limit this provision simply to the contracts issue that you're concerned with, without, so that we could somehow move your bill forward without getting mired down in a lot of other questions and concerns about other areas.
Yes, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, this first, it is something we could deal with in the conference committee, but I agree with you. I have questions here myself as well. This is the first time the subject has come up that has gone beyond just the individual business owner and the individual serviceman, for example, health club contracts that they're involved with, cell phone contracts, to extend beyond that to business contracts that extend backwards to their customers rather than individual protection for service members who are business owners. So I agree. I think we do need some clarification on the federal coverage.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, the Section 1 seems substantially different and is causing a lot of problems. Can we just look at Sections 2 through 5 and see if we can make part of that work, and then and look at the Section 1 part afterward?
Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, and I don't know if anybody pointed out on the fact sheet that was the stapled two pieces here that it does point out what the Service Members Civil Relief Act does not do. And that, then, I think is what's included in this bill, having to do with it says it fails to protect service members in a few important respects. The SCRA, the Service Members Civil Relief Act, allows service members to cancel motor vehicle and residential lease contracts, but they can't be utilized because it does not, however, extend the same rights to service contracts such as cellular phone plans, health and fitness, satellite TV, rental contracts. And so I think that that is what they're accomplishing then with this bill. Section 2 on are an extension of what the federal law does. Maybe you've already discussed that, but I think it's helpful to keep that in mind as we look at the subsequent sections to 1.
Senator Erickson-Ropes, I think Senator Foley is making a very good suggestion. So, members, I would recommend that we look at the rest of the bill and let's ask questions or of the witnesses on the rest of the bill. I think that Section 1, Senator Erickson-Ropes, is a little bit more problematic from a liability, or, you know, it's got implications beyond. This is the first time I've looked at the titles of that entire chapter, and I think it's going to be a little bit of a longer discussion.
Yes, Madam Chair, committee members, I believe our intent was really simply, again, to focus on the individual servicemen's ability to get out of contracts such as the individual contracts and not be stepping into the whole world of their business area.
Okay. Any questions for Senator Erickson-Ropes or the testifiers on Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 of the bill?
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Ropes, Erickson, on page 3, line 3.13, line 3.22, and line 3.28, all of those have got something relating to a permanent change of duties station. And it seems to me that is something that's pretty broad, and that we should not be looking at something that could merely transfer somebody from Minneapolis to Duluth or something on that order.
Senator Exum-Ropes.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, thank you very much for pointing that out. I think it needs to be broad, however, because you could get transferred from Duluth to Iraq very quickly as well. The cell phone that you rent in Duluth might be a local cell phone company. It doesn't work even in southern Minnesota. So, I mean, there may be opportunities. It gives people an opportunity just to take a look and see if the contract that they're involved with, whether it's a health club, a sports club contract, and now they're transferred out of the area, they would not be able to use. So whether they're going overseas or perhaps just to another Minnesota duty station, it certainly would affect some of the individual contracts that they're involved with.
And Senator Exum-Ropes, Section 3, with respect to the wireless contracts, does allow for the spouse to do the termination. And that was the question I had asked earlier, is which of these sections is applicable only to the service person and which allows other people to also act. And this is one of the provisions that does allow the spouse to also terminate.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions for Senator Exum-Ropes? Senator Olson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just in discussing with other committee members and wanting to move this bill forward, but having concerns about the real general provision, and we've looked up the Soldiers and Sailors Civil Relief Act, and just to give you an example, Senator Exum-Ropes, this covers, in addition to things like contracts and rent, it covers mortgages, liens, leases, insurance, taxes, and a host of other remedies that I don't think you're really intending to have us extend to businesses without talking about what that might mean. So I'm moving to delete Section 1, on which would be lines 1.7 through 1.11. This still leaves all the specific remedies that you're concerned with. And I would also say that I would be happy to work with you and introduce an amendment if there's something that we're somehow omitting, you know, back on the floor, if there's some specific thing that's somehow being left out of this. But I personally feel more comfortable that we're not going farther than we're intending by including this section.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, thank you very much, and that's why we wrote bills through the Judiciary Committee, because you're exactly right. It's not our intent to get into the whole business arena. This is individual servicemen's protection.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, I would like to point out, I hope that we do continue to work on this and that Senator Exum-Ropes isn't totally discouraged,
yes,
because I think there are specific needs of those people who are going to active duty who do have businesses, and, of course, many people do, whether it's a small law office, mm-hmm, or, you know, whatever that business is that they and maybe they and their spouse do or family members. So I know they have concerns and needs, and I hope we work on something to be more specific about how we can help.
Very good. Senator Olson moves that Section 1 of the bill be deleted. Any further discussions? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Olson moves that Senate File 532 as amended.
House File
532 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
Is there anyone in the audience that represents these businesses that might have an opinion on this bill?
Anybody else in the audience would like to testify either for or against this bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. This is our eighth committee hearing, and we have had no opposition.
Eighth? Did you say eight?
Between the House and the Senate.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, and we're representatives of these businesses at the Commerce Committee, and I think in some cases some of the companies are already doing some of these things, and there was not objection.
In a way, that's good that they were appropriately in the Commerce Committee, as that's where they should be. And Senator Exum-Ropes, just so that you're not discouraged, you are appropriately in the Judiciary Committee to raise questions about the liability type issue and how,
yes,
overbroad the application could be. And I think the committee members are doing what they need to do to help this bill along. So
Madam
I hope
Chair,
you're not
I
too discouraged.
Appreciate the insight of this committee.
All right. On Senator Olson's motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 All those opposed say nay.
Thanks.
The motion prevails.
Thank you.
Thank you, Colonel. Thank you, Mr. Bergstrom.
1 hour, 1 day.
Senator Clark.
Yeah.
Senate File 2173.
Good morning.
10:50. It starts.
Morning.
Yes. Good morning, Madam Chair and members. We have before you the bill today that is known as the Good Faith Bill. And I'm going to talk briefly about what we're trying to accomplish here, and then I'm going to turn it over to my esteemed colleague and have him go through and explain the bill in more detail for you before we get to questions. When each of us purchases insurance, we believe kind of two things are happening is that we're protecting ourselves by purchasing into a pool to prevent, in case something happens to us, that we can be compensated, that we can get essentially what we're needing to be made whole in those situations, because we can't afford to do it on our own. And so when we're pulling into this pool, we expect to get what we pay for. We have a lot of trust in that situation, and in most cases, certainly that is what happens. However, there are some situations in which either directly that an insurance company may decide not to make good on a whole claim, or there might be a mistake that is made. And right now, our law, while it expects good faith, it does not have any consequences if something would happen. And I think, as most of us know, we end up having laws that have consequences because of just the way human beings are. 90% of the people will do the right thing, but things happen in other situations. I'd liken it to a few different things. One would be, for example, we would have no need for jails if we really had laws that said don't steal and people would follow them. The reality is some people don't follow them. I think most of us, while we would want to obey laws with speeding, maybe cut it a little bit, and if we see a police officer, we slow down. Why? Because we know there's a consequence. My last example would be library books. Many of us want to return our library books on time, but the reality is there are fines because some of us, including at times myself, do not return them on time, and other people want those things. Those are all reasons why we have consequences. Right now, we do not have that, so it could be that a person has a claim that would make sense to be being paid out at $25,000. Perhaps they're told, well, we'll give you $15,000. And the reality is, if they have to try to get the extra $10,000, they'd have to go to court, but they'd have to be paying probably about that much money to just try to get what the rest of their claim is. And that's not the way things work in almost every other part of our system. So we want to expect good behavior, and that's the reason why we're focusing on good faith as opposed to saying bad faith. So some don't do this, and we need to change it. The other portion of this bill is allowing direct action, allowing direct first-party action. Currently, that is not allowed. So, for example, if my husband and I are driving, something happens, he is the one that is driving.
Senator Clark, yes. Is that in the bill, in this bill?
I believe it's still in that bill. Excuse me. Never mind. I thought we kept it in this version. Never mind. So that's all that is in there right now, Madam Chair. The other thing is that at times people have said that why not just go to the Department of Commerce? And the Department of Commerce has been clear that they can only resolve disputes based on the information provided and under their authority under Minnesota law. They have limited authority over third-party liability claims. They are unable to force insurers to pay claims. They cannot decide questions of fact. So while at times it would appear that there may be recourse for an individual, there really is none, and that's what we're attempting to address.
Thank you, Senator Clark. We'll hear from your testifier.
Thank you. I'm Peter Riley. I'm with Schwebel, Goetz & Sieben, and I've been representing injured people for the last 30 years. As I was reflecting last night about my remarks to you this morning, I was thinking about the fact that one of the most important things that you all as legislators have an opportunity to do is to take a situation where a playing field is not level and bring it level. And this is exactly that sort of bill, that sort of law. Right now, you have a playing field in what we call first party, and that's where someone has, for example, no-fault benefits, underinsured, uninsured, hail damage to their car or their roof, something like that, that type of claim where it's against their own insurer, you have an obligation under the law, the insurers do, to act in good faith. There's just one problem. We all know that a right without a remedy is no right at all. And right now there is no remedy. There is a remedy, and it's important for you to understand that we have good faith obligations in Minnesota for third-party claims. In other words, when I'm sued by someone because I caused a collision, my insurance company has the obligation to act in good faith to defend me against that claim. They have to hire an attorney. If they don't defend me, they have to pay the attorney's fees. That's already the law in the state of Minnesota under the Brown case, has been for a long time. And if they turn down an opportunity to settle a case within the policy limits and there's a bigger judgment, that becomes their obligation, not mine, if they fail to act in good faith. We already have that. So we have these exact sort of damages we're talking about in this bill when we're not protected by somebody else. Where we don't have it, ironically, is where you have purchased your own protection. Let me give you just one example. Actually, let me give you two. Yesterday, I happened to be, before I ever knew I was going to be seeing you folks this morning, I happened to be at a mediation with a very well-respected mediator who's a defense lawyer. And he walked in, and I'm not kidding you, this happened before I knew I was going to be here. And he said, here's a case, and he held up this file. He said, here's a case for first-party good faith law in the state of Minnesota. It's a young woman who, through no fault of her own, was in an accident, had a large scar on her face, and her ankle had been badly damaged. She had metal in it. She was going to be literally crippled in her right leg for the rest of her life. Now, the insurance company for the person who caused that crash was the same insurance company that had the underinsured motorist coverage, which you may know takes over when the other person doesn't have enough insurance. Same company. They immediately paid their underlying $30,000 of liability. Why? Because of their potential good faith damages I just told you about. But where they knew that there was no harm, they wouldn't even have to pay, ladies and gentlemen, interest on the additional $30,000. Now there had to be a lawsuit. Yes, that's right, Senator Scheid. They don't even have to, under this particular policy with this particular company, pay interest on the time, on the money that they hold all this time. It's amazing. But that's the law. What this statute would do is simply say, listen, if you, without an objectively reasonable basis, same standard they have, for example, in Florida, in Wisconsin, other states that have this, if they don't pay under that circumstance, if they deny, if they delay, then they have to pay attorney's fees and the other damages they cause. That's all this is about. That's all that this statute is talking about. They have an objectively reasonable basis to delay or deny. Fair enough. There are legitimate disputes. That's not what this is about. It's where there's no good reason. Let me give you one other example. Represented a young woman who was in an accident, was taken immediately after their SUV flip, was taken to the hospital. $5,000 hospital bill. That happened in August of 2005. That company kept saying to the hospital, send us the bill. They'd send it, they fax it, they had the fax records. I had the fax sheets. They kept saying, well, we don't have the bill, or it was sent someplace else, you sent it the wrong place. So I wrote, and I was very interested in Senator Clark's remark, I wrote to the Department of Commerce. And I said, there are two problems here. There's one with the bill, and there's one with her wage loss. Well, guess what happened after that happened? After about two more months of dinking around, they finally paid the hospital bill. And I got a nice letter from the Department of Commerce saying, well, you see, it got straightened out. They took care of it on their own. They ignored the wage loss question. Even though we have fax evidence of their getting the wage loss information they needed, they still haven't paid that poor young lady half of her wage loss. Still, right now as we sit here, and the Department of Commerce did nothing about it. That's why we need this bill. Now, there's a suggestion that's been made, I understand, that this is going to result in a whole bunch more lawsuits. And to the contrary, number one, it won't. We've had, keep in mind, this type of law for third party, remember the liability if I'm sued and I'm not properly protected or defended, for a very long time. I can think of two cases like that that have been tried. I tried one of them, and I know my old partner, Mike Weiner, tried another one called the Kisundath case. Those are the only two cases I can think of that were even litigated in that area. This is not going to have a create litigation. It's going to eliminate it because you won't have the cases like the one I told you about that was being mediated yesterday. There, the company's going to make that payment. That's the importance of this bill.
So, Mr. Riley, you're going to walk us through the bill?
I'd be happy to.
Section 1
simply requires that the insurer act in good faith and sets the standard as good faith if they delay or deny benefits without an objectively reasonable basis for its offer, delay or denial. Objectively reasonable, as I say. It's a common standard, Wisconsin, Florida, those sorts of places. So it's a very typical
Madam
way.
Madam Chair.
Senator Shy.
Madam Chair, forgive me because I don't want to interrupt, but I don't think that's the standard in those states.
That's the Anderson case, Senator.
I believe
Senator
that,
Shy.
Madam Chair, virtually every case I've read uses reckless disregard.
Not the Anderson case in Wisconsin?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator Shide.
Madam Chair, I don't know. I have the Wisconsin court language, and I think that that's the second part of the test, that there has to be reckless disregard. But I could be shown wrong in a paragraph.
Allow me to read from the Anderson case. Yes,
hang
I'm sorry,
on a
sir.
Second here.
Sir,
all right?
Madam Chair.
I understand that this issue is matters to a whole lot of people. Okay, so I'm going to try to manage our discussion of this issue. And I'm asking Senator Shide to hold off. I'm well aware, Senator Shide, of some of the inconsistencies.
Okay.
And so I would like Mr. Riley to give his testimony, and then I would like to invite the other testifiers to come up and testify. And then we will have both sides of the story on the table, Senator Shide, and I think that your position will be...
Madam Chair, and I apologize for interrupting. I just felt that... This is one of those areas of contention. And I'll be quiet now. I do have to leave at 9:45.
I know.
And so I apologize for that because I kind of thought we were going to – I was here at 8 o'clock. I was ready to go.
I know. I apologize.
Madam Chair, you set it to be first on the agenda or close to first to my benefit so that I could be here, and I appreciate that. So I'll be quiet.
Thanks. I have an overdue library book, too, I was just reminded about, so I'll go on quickly. Insurance policy does not include workers' comp or health insurance. The reason for that I won't get into at this particular point. It defines, number one, defines insurance company. Two, provides the penalty or remedy.
Senator Limmer?
Madam Chair, I have to object that the snide comment you just made to our committee about an overdue library book.
Oh, I apologize. I was just referencing Senator Clark's reference about an overdue library book.
Well, I think some of us, I'd like to caution you, sir, that some of us didn't take it as that.
I apologize. I apologize to the committee. I did not mean it as that at all. I've known many of you for a number of years, and I didn't mean it that way. I apologize, Senator.
Mr. Riley?
Yes.
Mr. Riley?
Sure. Subdivision 2 is penalties and remedies. It simply provides for costs, damages, and reasonable attorney's fees. I think I already outlined the reasoning for that. Subdivision 3 deals with the limited liability of insurance producers, simply because unless they were directly involved, they're not liable for some conduct that was made of some adjuster someplace else for obvious reasons. And then there is to be a report to the commissioner, as you can see, about these types of claims. They have to be reported, and then there's a report to the legislature about how often these problems come up.
Senator Clark and Senator Scheid, the report to the commissioner and the report to the legislature, is this an attempt to try to get at some information about what's if this does become law, just to get some information about the lay of the land? It strikes me that when we pass, or is it common to in insurance situations to have to report to the commissioner? My sense is that it seems unusual rather to have to report to the legislature, but my sense is that we want to get a sense of what the lay of the land is. Senator Shide?
Madam Chair, this was in the original bill. Was it 11-something? The first bill that was heard in Commerce and the subsequent bill. It's not something that the Commerce Committee did, nor do we see it very often, and I don't think it's common.
The report to the commissioner?
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Clark, what's the thought behind that?
Madam Chair, the thought was as you suggested, because there has been, I believe that this is a very common mechanism in most states. Since it has been controversial here, we thought that it made sense to begin at bringing some information back. Having said that, it certainly, if this committee determines that it does not want to include it, it would be all right to delete that section.
Mm-hmm. All right, any questions for Senator Clark or Mr. Riley? Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, would this cover insurance policies that are sold to Minnesotans while they are spending the winters in Arizona, Texas, Florida, wherever? Let me tell you where I'm coming from. My parents went to Texas and, you know, for 25 years, I suppose. And when my dad was really sick and we were trying to get him back home before he died, he kept saying, I have this insurance policy. I have this insurance policy. And everybody in their park had these little cards. And it was an insurance policy to get you home from Texas in the event that you died or you were incapacitated. And they somebody goes around to all of these Minnesotans and Iowans and North Dakotans and Wisconsin guys and sells them these policies. Well, actually trying to get him home was, you know, just damned impossible. I call up and it's like, well, no, we can't do that. Well, no, that isn't what that means. And, well, no, that isn't what that means. And you've all seen me lose my temper. I really lost my temper trying to get my dad home. And so I'm wondering whether this would protect the Minnesotans who get that stupid policy.
Question to me.
Mr. Riley?
If it's a Minnesota contract of insurance or issued in Minnesota, yes.
No.
It would issued have been, in Texas? If it's issued in Texas, it would be governed by Texas law or perhaps federal law, depending upon the nature of the contract.
Do you know if they have a good faith law in Texas?
They do. They do 46 out of 50 states plus the District of Columbia, Senator.
Good to know. Thank you.
Yes.
All right.
And it's good one, by the way.
I know that the industry is here and they've asked to testify. So let's bring the other testifiers to the table. And then once the testimony is on the table, we will then have a discussion. My understanding is, and I'm not on the Commerce Committee, but this bill is substantially smaller than the bill that was in the Commerce Committee, Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, yes, it doesn't include the direct action piece that was in the other bill. But I think otherwise, I don't think anything was changed. I think that's true.
Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Dale Thornsjo, Thornsjo, private practitioner in Minneapolis.
Madam Chair and committee members, I know that time is of the essence here. I'll be brief. And what I would like to do, Madam Chair and committee members, is actually point to some words in the bill and then make some comments, two comments in particular, primary areas. And we oppose Senate File 2173, this version. We oppose the earlier version that Senator Scheid referenced that was heard in her committee. That's the version that's in a budget bill on the House side. But if I can, just I'd like to put this bill in the context of what's happening in America. That's what I'd like to do. So there's a lot of discussions about 46 states and 35 states and what have you. But I think I can do that in a relatively succinct way and then point out how Senate File 2173 is decidedly different than the nation as we're referring to this. And the first one would be on line 1.8, and as you have heard, the descriptions and the proponents have said that it's important that people get what they pay for. So that would be the policyholder or the insured, whoever buys the auto policy, the homeowner, the property, the liability. And this bill is crafted to apply to any matter involving a claim under an insurance policy. So let's take a liability policy.
I see.
And this is how I read it, and I believe a number of lawyers that I have talked to who are practitioners read it this way, that any matter involving a claim would apply to, let's say, I buy the liability policy, so I'm the insured. I buy the policy. But if I do something negligent and I get sued, the person that is suing me, that'd be a third party, they would also have the protection or the given the rights under this bill, because that's any matter involving a claim under a policy. So our read of this bill and the earlier bill is this puts a new standard for first and third party. And Madam Chair and committee members, if you look at the literature, I know we don't have the time today, there are volumes of law review articles, academic treatises, and the very court cases, and you will see the description of whether or not an insured, a policyholder, is given this additional right to file what's called around the country a bad faith lawsuit. This is referred to as good faith practices, but if you don't do the good faith practice, you do something else. It's bad faith. And so that's why the literature will refer to it. So the first thing that uniquely this bill is coming to this legislature is that it is a first and third party, and so this gives that right to the person that buys the liability policy and to the person that's suing. So that one liability insurer is now obligated to act in good faith to the two sides of the contract. And I'm going to suggest, Madam Chair, that an examination of the substantive literature will show you that is not what the court cases around America, and that is not what the statutes around America. We don't have the time here to bring the 12 states have passed laws much, much, much more detailed than Senate File 2173. I actually read the Florida law last night, so maybe I'll make a couple of comments because Florida was referenced. And I read the Wisconsin Supreme Court case, the Anderson decision, and I'll come to that. So that's the first matter that uniquely distinguishes this bill and the other versions of the bill that are at the legislature. The second matter. These are the only 2 points I have. The second matter is on line 1.10. It's the triggering standard. In other words, what level of conduct by an insurance company reaches this level where the individual has this additional remedy? They have the right today to sue under the contract.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Mr. Johnson, it helps us if you point to the words, not to the line. Which phrase are you talking about?
Sure.
Mr.
No, well, 1.10, Madam Chair, Senator Betzel, the key triggering language is objectively reasonable basis.
Okay. Thank you.
And so on those three words, the question is, how does that position this, Minnesota, with the rest of the nation? And the reference has been to 46 states. Most states have created a extra contractual remedy, is what it's actually called, by decision, Supreme Court decision. So you have to read each of those court cases. 12 states have passed a law. But here's my comment, Madam Chair, is that this is not the norm of what's found around America. What is the norm? Well, interestingly, what the norm is the Anderson versus Continental Insurance Company, Wisconsin Supreme Court case from 1978. And that court standard is not what's found in Senate File 2173. It is not objectively reasonable basis. It is a two-prong test. There's no question it's a two-prong test, and it's referred to as an objective and a subjective, and you have to meet both parts of the test. The second part of the test is the insurer had to act with knowledge or reckless disregard of a lack of a reasonable basis for denying a claim. Reckless disregard. That's called an intentional standard. The Wisconsin Supreme Court case is the case that 23 other states cite as their standard for authorizing a first party. Now I'll loop the 2 points together. For authorizing the person that paid the premium, not the person that's suing the person that paid the premium. And so the Anderson Supreme Court case, I won't rattle through them here, Madam Chair, but there's a Tort Trial and Insurance Practice Law Journal of the fall of 1970, of the fall of 2004. It's an authoritative article in the American Bar Association, the TIP section by some lawyers, practitioners that go through all of the Supreme Court cases, and they go through the specifics of the statutes. And I know we don't have the time here, but on those 2 points, this bill is decidedly different. It is broader in its scope, and it is a low threshold to cross into to be able to file the lawsuit. And for that reason, it is dramatically different. The Florida statute that was referenced, Florida, and I we just don't have the time here. Florida statute is...
Mr. Johnson, I don't want you to be rushed that yeah. we don't have the time.
Okay.
This is a very important matter, and we, the Judiciary Committee, takes this issue very seriously. So we take pride that we don't allow products to leave this committee without giving it due consideration. And if there's something critical that we need to understand, we will make the time to allow that to happen. So, you know, please don't feel like you have to rush over things.
Well, Madam Chair, those are the two specific parts of the bill with the specific words that make it unique compared to the Supreme Courts around America that have created a remedy, and make it unique compared to the statutes that have been passed. And I was going to reference Florida, but I, at another time, I know we don't have time, but the copies of the statutes are instructive as to how each of those state legislatures have crafted it. But I'll end with this, Madam Chair, is that the report on I've never seen, I've lobbied for insurance for 30 years in Minnesota. I have never seen a reporting of civil settlements to the Commerce Department Section 2. That's never done because the Commerce Department doesn't regulate civil litigation. They regulate the Settlement of Claims Practices Act, 72A.201, and they have no role or position or reason to be collecting settlements in a court system under the action authorized here. So, Madam Chair, we don't think this bill runs afoul and is outside of the norm of what is found around America, both in common law and in statutes. And I'll end with, we think we have a contrary to, and Senator Scheid's committee had Deputy Commissioner Pat Nelson describe what Commerce does to enforce Minnesota laws. They opened 3,800 files last year to police the statutes to make sure insurance companies of all lines complied with the state statute, and they leveled civil penalties of some $4 million to make certain that insurance companies complied with law and consumers got the benefit under the statutes that you all have created. In fact, the statutes that they are in force are the statutes that were drafted and passed by this legislature in 1984, drafted by then-Commerce Commissioner Mike Hatch under Governor Rudy Perpich, who wrote and passed 72A.201, which is comprehensive claim settlement practices legislation to protect consumers. So, Madam Chair and committee members, those are the key points from our industry as to why we're opposing the bill, and we believe that consumers have a remedy, and it's been actively enforced by the Commerce Department. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Thornstow.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dale Thornstow. I'm an attorney in private practice in the Minneapolis area. I'm also the co-chair of the Minnesota Defense Lawyers Association Insurance Law Committee. I've represented both policyholders and insurance companies as part of my practice, and I'm here to oppose Senate File 2173. Mr. Johnson has already gone through how this bill is out of step with American jurisprudence without addressing a specific ill of the insurance industry. I know that other committees have addressed this bill. They have, like Mr. Riley has this morning, focused on the first-party aspect of the claims, and this bill goes far beyond that, as Mr. Johnson stated. Another concern that I have is that, frankly, this will cost taxpayers in higher premiums, as confirmed by the Department of Commerce in prior testimony, as well as in higher court costs, as well as delays in resolution of civil cases. It's important to keep in mind that while the 1984 case of Morris versus American Family, which is indirectly the case that Mr. Riley was referencing, which states that there is not a private first-party cause of action under the Fair Claims Handling Act, is currently the law, and in fact the Supreme Court invited the legislature to address the issue if it so wished, again only in a first-party context. The courts of this state continue to regulate good faith conduct of insurance carriers. In fact, there's a major good faith, bad faith case up before the Court of Appeals that is pending right now. This periodic regulation by the judiciary appears to be more than sufficient to be able to address those issues, except for those limited issues that have been brought before the court here. A great concern that I have is this standard that Mr. Johnson went through, and my only comment on this is that I have colleagues that I have presented in various cases around the country with in various seminars, and one of the colleagues that I know is from Tampa, Florida, and she has informed me that the standard rule in Florida is, under this Florida statute, is that it's in essence a gotcha statute. And Madam Chair and members of the committee, the concern with the term gotcha is that the statute basically allows policyholders to set up insurance carriers for any type of a bad faith and to stonewall insurance carriers and basically create the bad faith action by their own mechanisms. And this bill, much more liberal than the Florida bill, will have that happen, just as it did in California in the 1979 decision in California, where subsequently filings went up 40% as a result of imposition of a tort bad
Mr.
faith claim.
Thornjo, I know that you made the time to be here, and I just the gist of what this committee is interested in, I mean, reasonable people representing different sides of the issue will differ on what the speculative outcome is going to be. And we can stay here all day, and I think both sides will be halfway right in terms of what the outcome is going to be. What I am interested in is to spend the next 15, 20 minutes. I know Senator Scheid has to leave, and I really like to, with your expertise at the table and with this committee, take a look at the two issues that were raised by Mr. Johnson and get input from Mr. Riley as to the concerns that were raised by the industry about the any matter language and the objective reasonable basis standard.
Sure.
That's what I'd like to get to, if we can have that conversation. And I'd like to do that to give some time for Senator Scheid to have input. So I apologize to cut you short, Mr. Thornjo, but as we move in that direction, I'm going to come back to you to help us discern and get some input on those two areas. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, there were many points that I would be happy to address if we were going to go into that level of discussion. And just based on my own personal involvement with this issue, I have to say that historically there are some things that have been said at this table that I don't believe are accurate. And so if it's important to this committee that we have a full understanding of the history of the Unfair Claims Practices Act in this state and whether it was intended by Mr. Former Attorney General Hatch to provide for a first-party or remedy or not. This committee might be interested in that history. Since I've raised that, I think I'd just like to explain a little bit what I'm talking about. In some states, we have a remedy when the insurance industry acts in bad faith as to its insured in statute. In other states, we have that remedy implied, and it's been developed under the common law. In this particular state, we put in place standards for the insurance industry to follow under the Unfair Claims Practices Act. And in most other states, when there are those kinds of standards in place, they've been adopted to provide a remedy to the insured when those standards are violated through the common law, so that the person who's been affected has a first-party right to hold their insurance company accountable when they act in bad faith and violate those standards. My understanding is that our former Attorney General wrote an opinion explaining that he thought that there was going to be a first-party right of action implied under that statute. But when this issue was litigated, Mr. Johnson and the insurance industry representatives, I believe, have issued opinions to the court indicating that if the legislator had wanted there to be a first-party action, it should have been written into the law. So ironically, with an intent to provide protection for consumers that was actually used against consumers to say, well, because it doesn't say so, we're not going to, you know, the argument was you shouldn't, through the court system, provide that remedy. But then when this issue has come back to the legislature, the same people who issued those or who have made that argument to the courts have come to us and said, well, because the courts didn't find, because leave it to the courts, I guess, is basically what they've said. Let the courts find this remedy as they've done in other states. So what's been happening over the years since this act was initiated is that finger-pointing back and forth by the same insurance industry has been used to prevent the insured from having the same type of remedy that they have in most other states, whether under common law or whether by statute. So I just want to make sure that we have that history in this situation clear, because in the Commerce Committee it was stated or somehow implied by some of the witnesses that somehow our former Attorney General endorses the lack of a first-party action. And actually nothing could be further from the truth based on his own writings. So I think it's important we have that history.
Senator Olson and members, let me put this on the table. The issue is before this committee, and it is up to us to make a policy decision, not on intent, not based on implication, not based on case law. But it is squarely in our jurisdiction today to decide whether or not we're going to create this first right of action. So my suggestion is, and if the consensus is, and our discussion is, and I sense that that's the direction where we want to go, is to do that. Then I'd like to engage in the discussion before Senator Scheid leaves, whether or not in doing that, the language that's in here is the appropriate, is it too broad, is it too narrow, are we going beyond what other states are from what is the general practice out there. And that's what I would like to have the discussion with the experts here at the table to engage in that discussion. If we don't do that, once this bill leaves this committee, we won't have an opportunity to address the standard that's being used and sort of the limitations or the broadness of what this is. So I understand. I mean, there are different views on how we got to where we are today, and there are going to be different views on what the implications are going to be. But my sense is that members in this committee already have a consensus on where they want to go. And so I'd like to get us to the nitty-gritty of looking at the specific elements. Unless the consensus in the committee is, let's just pass this bill out of here the way it is. And frankly, I guess I'm a little bit more hesitant. I think that we should do our due diligence to respond to some of the concerns that have been raised to say, do we really want, if we choose to go this route, you know, do we want it to be any matter, or could we be a little bit more restrictive? And is the objectively reasonable basis, you know, the only standard that we can use, or do we have other options? That's direction where I want to go. So can we focus on that discussion? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for indulging me with my speech about the history. But since that was raised, and since, again, I just wanted to throw that in there since Mike Hatch's name again came up. Related to your specific issue, in terms of whether this law is more restrictive or less restrictive than other states, since Florida was raised, I just would like to compare this to what happens in Florida, and then I'll move to a suggestion with respect to that first language that you raised. My understanding, first of all, with third-party claims, just so we understand the difference between what third-party claims allow right now, if I'm trying to settle a claim, if I'm representing someone who's been hurt, and it's obvious that that person should be paid the limit of the claim. Let's say it's $30,000 and they have $1 million worth of damages. And the insurance company acts in bad faith in refusing to settle. And I go to court and I get $1 million worth of a settlement, or excuse me, of an award. The insurance company will have to pay that full $1 million potentially. And that's the penalty for acting in bad faith in third-party situations. In Florida law, my understanding is that there is a similar penalty in the law for first-party claims. And so there's a much broader potential for damages to be awarded when there's a breach of faith or bad faith under Florida law in first-party claims than what's being proposed in this law. This law does not open up, the way I'm reading it, for a potential for an unlimited amount of damages to be recovered simply because the insurance company acts in bad, or not simply, when the insurance company acts in bad faith. It simply says that a person has a right to collect their costs, damages, and reasonable attorney's fees that are caused because when someone does act in bad faith. So I think that the damages remedy is quite a bit more limiting. But with respect to the issue of whether this
Madam
is broader...
Senator Higgins.
Before Senator Olson goes on, can I ask just a basic question?
Yes.
What's the difference between a first-party claim and a third-party claim?
Senator
Olson has the most amazing way of explaining things that I can really understand, but she skipped over that part, and if she'd just help me with that one, that'd be great.
Sure.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, if... I'll put this on you. If you're driving a car and you're drunk and you come across the line...
Bad idea.
And I fall asleep, let's say.
Okay, if you're... Well, if, let's just say you run a stoplight. We'll use that example.
Okay.
You run a stoplight and you have insurance, and I and Senator Scheid is hurt as a result. She's coming through the intersection from the other direction. She can pursue a claim against you, and your insurance company has to pay her. That's a third-party claim because it's not her insurance company paying her. It's your insurance company paying her. And so that's the type of third-party claim we're talking about. And that's the normal type of situation that comes up when people are in accidents, usually, for that type of thing.
Okay.
A first-party claim would be, let's just say that Senator Scheid, same situation, let's just say you don't have insurance. And so Senator Scheid has to rely on her own insurance policy's uninsured coverage. And so she can't, she doesn't pursue a claim against you because you don't have any insurance. She pursues a claim directly against her insurance company for the uninsured coverage. Or in a situation where you did have insurance, but it wasn't enough, and she has what's called under insurance coverage, it goes back to her own insurance policy, and that coverage stacks on top of yours.
So she would possibly, in that situation, have a third-party claim and a first-party claim?
Right. That's correct, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Higgins. And the whole problem that evolves here is that we already recognize that your insurance company has an obligation to act in good faith with respect to you, and if they don't, indirectly, Senator Scheid gets the benefit of that because she'll be able to pursue those damages if they don't act in good faith, because it's putting you in a bad spot if they don't act in good faith with settling your claim. But when she has to deal with her own insurance company directly, we don't have that same remedy in place for the person who purchases insurance.
Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
I know that you were hoping that Mr. Riley could at least address the two things that were brought up, and I believe he could do so briefly because the Anderson case actually has two – it isn't just reckless. It's knowledge or reckless. So I think it has been a bit characterized at a slightly higher standard than the case actually states. So I would just appreciate briefly before you decide where you want to go that we could at least let him respond to what was brought up.
Before we get to the objective, I want to make sure that maybe the committee understands this and it's okay. You know, the examples that we've been using in this discussion have been auto insurance. But under the definition of insurance policies that are being contemplated here, it's every type of insurance other than workers' compensation insurance or contract or other policy or contract of health care. So it's other than workers' comp or health insurance policies, it's every other type of insurance. And so am I accurate in that it is your intention to create a first-party claim in all the other types of insurance policies, right, outside of workers' comp and health? correct, Senator Clark?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Madam Chair, the predominant two situations would be liability and auto.
And homeowners. That's common in most other states when we talk about first-party claims, that in the states who do have first-party claims, it is that broad. It's applicable to all others with the exception of workers' comp and health. Or are there other limitations of other areas that are not included? Mr. Riley?
To my knowledge, and I've looked at a few of the specific statutes, but in most cases it is that broad, which gives rise to the homeowners' claims that we're familiar with from Katrina and so forth.
Mr. Johnson, is that correct?
Madam Chair, I think that's correct. I don't have copies of the statutes with me, or I believe that when the courts have created that remedy, which is in most states the common law remedy, they broadly apply it.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, moving to the issue that you raised on lines 1.7 and 1.8, the concern seemed to be that this is something that not just applies to first-party claims but also third-party claims. Well, I'm not quite sure why there is that concern, since we already have third-party claims being recognized, but if that really is an issue, some language that I could suggest that would make it clear, I think what the intent of this bill would be if we inserted after the small a, the phrase, as to its insured, comma, and then it would go on to say, an insurer shall act in good faith in connection with any matter involving a claim under an insurance policy. And then before the period, if we inserted the words between the insured and the insurer, then it would make it clear that we're not really trying to do something, but actually we already have the right to do that anyway. But it would make it sure that we're limiting this to the first party situation. And I think that would eliminate that concern. But if we did that, then I'm also going to suggest that under remedies, we would have to add something that would say, nothing in this section shall be interpreted to limit other remedies already available under existing Minnesota law, because we want to make it clear that we're not eliminating the third-party remedy that we already have by simply limiting this to a first-party claim in the statute.
Mr. Riley, Mr. Johnson?
There's a long-winded answer that I won't give you as to why that would – I understand exactly what the senator's talking about. We could certainly work with that. It really doesn't change anything, as she said. And there's a whole explanation of how you go through a third-party claim and the mechanics of it that I won't bore you with that make it better to be able to
Senator
bring
Shide?
The action directly.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the key to this – one of the keys to this bill has to do – with the penalty and remedy section. I think this bill is about attorney fees. It's about additional lawsuits and attorney fees, and I think it's disingenuous at best to say that this is going to create fewer lawsuits. Indeed, there may be some more settlements at a higher dollar amount because insurance companies don't want to be subjected to, the ultimate penalty here if there were sheer negligence on their part in denying a claim or delaying, perhaps. I think that's what this bill is about, and so I don't think that the authors of the legislation would like to do what Senator Olson is saying, because I do think this is about more lawsuits and attorney's fees, which today you don't get. I believe it comes out of the award.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Well, Senator Shide, actually, again, I know that I have a personal bias in this issue, so I don't expect you to just assess it. But we've all dealt with issues here, and we all try to – I think we can all make up our own minds and think for ourselves, but we do lay our personal experiences on the table for discussion. And I have to tell you that in situations where it's very clear that a case should be settled, the threat of bad faith, the threat of some type of penalty will allow for there to be a resolution that does not require litigation, and this happens all the time. In these first-party situations, which don't come along nearly as often because, as we explained, most of the times people have insurance and we're dealing with third-party third-party situations. But in first-party situations, over and over again, in my experience, there will be a case that is very clear that should be paid. But when the insurance company knows that the worst thing that can happen to them is that they'll have to make that payment, they will always say something like, not always, I don't want to paint every brush this is, but very often what happens is they'll say, well, why should we pay you the $30,000 even if your client is going to end up in a wheelchair or whatever, when we know that if you pursue this claim, you're going to have to hire an attorney and you're going to have to pay a third of your claim in attorney's fees, and it's going to take you a long time to get the money from us. And so we'll just give you $20,000 or $15,000, and you'll end up in the same place anyway. So even though you've paid for that $30,000 worth of coverage, it is very difficult to get it a payment from some insurance companies, which then forces litigation. In situations where the person doesn't have to hire an attorney in order to get a fair payment, I see that consumers are going to save money in attorney's fees and not have to go to hire an attorney. So I don't consider that to be disingenuous at all. And I guess I don't want to get into what I would consider disingenuous, because that's probably – then we're, this is going to not go where it probably needs to go. But to be claiming somehow to consumers that this is going to cause two lawsuits to be filed in every situation is what I would consider highly disingenuous.
Well, let me remind members that I did say that different people will have different opinions on either side. My sense is that the rush to help me amend this bill before we send it off is just overwhelming to me. So, Senator Olson, would you like to move this bill?
Yes, I would, Madam Chair. I would like to, unless there's any indication that the from Mr. Johnson that the insurance industry would prefer the language that would address the concern that he had, then I'd like to go ahead and move the bill to move
Senate File
2173
be recommended to pass.
Be recommended to pass and referred
to the Commerce Committee.
Is the Commerce Committee going to meet again before the...
I don't think...
Madam Chair.
Senator Clark?
I recognize I'm not on this, but I would ask that the committee refer it to rules because today is deadline. The bill is, frankly, without the direct action, significantly smaller than it was in Commerce, and I think that it should go to rules so that a determination can be made about what best to do with this bill. I frankly think in the state that is, it could actually go to the floor, but out of deference to the Commerce Committee Chair, I think sending it to rules is where it ought to go.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
It's highly unusual to send a bill to rules unless it's got a reason to go to rules. We don't just send it there because we're at a deadline day. Otherwise, they're going to be swamped with bills. If Senator Scheider or somebody believes that this bill should not be going straight to the floor, there's an appropriate motion that can be made on the floor, which would then cause the bill to go to the Rules Committee. So I don't think sending it to the Rules Committee is appropriate. I do have one or two very technical things, and if we could just take a quick look at those, Madam Chair, just as quick amendment. On page 1, line 8, I don't know that the words "with any matter" really add anything to the bill. I mean, you know, an insurer shall act in good faith in connection with involving a claim under insurance policy. I think that that's what it is. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it "with any matter" means, so I'd, unless there's any
line 1.8, delete any matter?
With any matter.
With or, any matter?
No, actually, I think you do in connection.
In connection.
To be act in good faith involving a claim.
Involving a claim. Yeah, in connection with any matter, I'm sorry.
All
act
right.
In good faith involving a claim. So strike the words "in connection with any matter."
Any discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, on line 10, I don't know what an objectively reasonable basis is as opposed to just a reasonable basis. So I think if we just strike "an objectively" and just have without a reasonable basis.
Insert A.
Yeah, Madam Chair. We'd like to speak.
Senator Clark.
Mr. Riley, speak to that briefly.
the difficulty you have there, for example, the objectively reasonable basis is then gives you a standard to look at. We have some law from other states. Wisconsin, for example, uses that standard. So we'll have a body of law to look to. If you
but
don't.
They don't govern here in Minnesota.
No, I understand that.
And we're making our own law here.
Yes, you are. Yes, you
and
are, Madam Chair.
Then will become its own body of law.
It could, correct. but I would think an insurance company would want to have some objectively reasonable basis to take action. But if they'd prefer to just have it any basis that they want, just reasonable care, that's perfectly fine. Negligence is a broader standard. That would broaden it. That'd be fine.
Yeah, Madam Chair, it is a broader standard. It is a broader standard than what we are bringing forward.
Mr. Johnson.
Well, Madam Chair, I think I'm past the point here that if we want to adopt Wisconsin, there's enough lawyer talent in the Twin Cities to read the Anderson case. It's a two-pronged test. It says objective, subjective, and you can write the Anderson standard right in, and I'm confident if that's the desire, this committee can codify the Wisconsin-Anderson Supreme Court standard, and that's decidedly different than what's in the bill. So I'm confused here with the testimony.
Senator Betzel, you
I'll withdraw it for right now. I'm fine. Madam Chair, on page 2, this bill would not go to the floor. It would probably have to go to the Finance Committee because we're requiring the Commissioner of Commerce to keep track of reports, make reports to the legislature. I'm sure there's a fiscal impact there, and I'm not convinced hearing the testimony that this is even needed. So I think if we deleted lines 2.8 through 2.10, which is where the insurance have to make reports of every settlement award, and then the report in Section 2, I think that would prevent a fiscal note.
What about the report, Senator Betzel?
That Section 2, which is 2.13 and 2.20. If you delete Section 2, and then the lines 2.8 through 2.10, which ties into Section 2.
Any discussions? Senator Clark?
As I said, it does not kill the bill to go ahead and get rid of that. The information would be good, and I'm fine with it going to finance. So,
she objects to your amendment. Any further discussions from the committee members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make reference to Amendment A2.
A2 amendment.
And that'll have to be modified now that Senator Betzold's motion.
Can you? Is it a big amendment?
Focus on page 2, line 16. Oh, wait, that we've already removed that. Oh, I withdraw the amendment.
Now, Senator Olson renews her motion that Senate File 2173, as amended, be recommended to pass, and I would think it be re-referred to the Committee on Commerce.
Madam Chair.
Senator Schott.
Madam Chair, I don't have a book to return. I feel very strongly about this bill. That's not what's upsetting me. I wish I had a book to return. I will tell you, I certainly think it ought to come back to Commerce, if you will. I understand it's different than the first bill. There is no question in my mind, having looked at issues of insurance for something over 15 years, within the legislative experience, there's no question in my mind that this will increase premiums. You know, some people look at the world and see victims. I look at the world, particularly my district that I represent, and I see hardworking, tax-paying, mortgage-paying, college tuition-paying, gas tax-paying, utility-paying, insurance premium-paying citizens. And we sometimes tax them directly, and sometimes we do it indirectly. But for anybody to say to you in writing or here that this won't increase costs, and I don't think anybody said it today, so I'm not casting, any doubt on what they've said in pertaining to that. But I've seen written material. There won't be more lawsuits. There won't be increased costs. Of course there will be, creating new levels of lawsuit. And you're going to see increased awards based on what I said earlier. to avoid other lawsuit costs and attorney's fees on top of awards, insurance companies, yours and my insurance companies, will be in a position of settling sooner. I think that the people who will be happiest about this will be, I understand that the victims, and you know, I could need a good trial lawyer myself. I don't object to the plaintiff's attorneys at all. I may need one someday. I'm supporting one for president. It drives me nuts, but I am. In spite of that, I guess, no. No, I respect everyone practicing law, and I appreciate everyone's passion on the issue, but I'm confident that I can sit here and tell you, you will be causing premiums to go up. And I think, and I don't know that I can quantify it. I'm sure, I think other states' experiences has been 10%+. That's significant on my homeowner's policy of $1,000 already this year, you know, in a year. It's significant on auto policies, which are higher than our neighbors because we're a no-fault state. I think we ought to think about that. I think this should come to Commerce, but I have no doubt that the proponents of this bill, seeing how hard they've worked to get this to this point, are going to do something to get beyond that. I just as soon
send it off.
Send it. I don't care if you go to the floor. I should. I know you'll get around it. You'll get it out of Commerce Committee. I didn't plan to meet. I thought I would let leadership tell my committee they had to meet, and I'd be there. If that's the case, I can do that. Maybe I should ask Senator Clark if that's what she would like the Commerce Committee to do tomorrow. I just didn't feel like asking them because they did give this bill a lot of time.
Well, Senator Scheid, as my obligation is to get this bill to your committee. Now, if your preference is that you've already have a thorough discussion on the issue you would recommend that this just goes to the floor, then that would be the action that would be taken in this committee. But it is not my intention to bypass the Commerce Committee.
Madam Chair, I understand that.
Yeah.
But I'm not planning to have a hearing, and I don't play games. I try to be straightforward with everybody, particularly you, Madam Chair. And you did have this bill early today so that I could be here. I don't really have time to say, you know, everything that I wanted to say, but I won't demand that it come to Commerce because I can honestly tell you I'm not planning to hear it. It wouldn't meet the deadline. It would have to be brought out of Commerce by some other way. I have no doubt that would happen. I am willing to forego it going to Commerce at this point.
Senator Betzel. For that reason.
Madam Chair, Senator Shai, just to be clear, policy committees technically can meet after the deadline. It just means that if a bill is reported out, it then goes straight to the Rules Committee as a late bill.
Oh. Yeah.
It's we're not prohibited from meeting. It's just where the bills will go after.
Forgive
after
me,
the
you know, and I'm sorry, I forgot that I have some other things on my mind. Madam Chair, then I would like it to come to Commerce, and we will hear it, and we'll hear it next week.
All right. Then Senator Olson renews her motion that Senate File 2173 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce. Any further discussions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
Nope. Motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Clark? The Judiciary Chair would strongly encourage both sides to take a look at the issues that were raised in this committee on its way to the Commerce Committee. Senator Prettner-Solon. Senator Prettner-Solon, I believe we're going to take 140 first, or whichever one that's on top of your file.
That's
I don't
fine.
Want to mess you up.
Madam Chair, that's fine with me.
All right.
I do have some handouts.
We'll have our staff help with that.
What was the question?
No.
And Madam Chair, Senate File 140 is the Restroom Access Act. This bill is designed primarily to provide access to private restroom facilities and public places of business for individuals with fecal or urinary incontinence due to a medical condition. One of the more common medical conditions affiliated with this symptom is, with these symptoms, is Crohn's disease or colitis. And there are 30,000 Minnesotans who live with Crohn's and colitis. To put it simply, the Restroom Access Act requires a retail establishment that has a toilet facility for its employees to allow customers to use that facility during business hours if the following criteria are met. First, the customer requesting the use of the employee toilet facility suffers from Crohn's disease, colitis, or an ineligible medical condition. Three or more employees are working at the time. The retail establishment does not already make a restroom available to the public, and the access to a toilet facility is not located in an area that would create a health or safety risk to the customer, and a public restroom is not available. Also, retail establishments are not required to make any physical changes to a toilet facility to accommodate the provisions in this bill. The bill before this committee, or the part of the bill that is before the committee to examine, is the liability provision of the language, which is subdivision 4, section or page 2, line 7, and I have an amendment for that. That is the A2 amendment.
You know, Senator Partner Solon, when I was looking at this bill, I was looking if pregnant women were included in this list. A couple of years ago, that was quite an issue.
Yes.
Has the amendment been passed out?
No.
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 No. No. Maybe.
And, Madam Chair, I'd just like to make comment that the amendment is regarding liability language, and it is a compromise that was worked out between the trial lawyers and the retail association.
Is this the A2 amendment
it
that
is.
You're talking about?
It
right.
is. And, Madam Chair, I'll wait.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Senator Prentner, so on. Have you ever been into the United Kingdom?
No, I've Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I've sailed past the cliffs of Dover. That's the closest I've gotten.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
The reason I ask that question is that there's a whole proliferation of restrooms, if you want to call them that, in the various stores and so forth. And I remember the most of them charge a price for doing that. And as I recall, Harrods was one that had like £2 to utilize the facility. And further in that, there are systems that are designed so that when you get through using the facility, why you close the door and it sanitizes the place.
I see.
So maybe you want to ask for some voluntary use on there in charge of fee.
Senator Prentner Solon?
Madam Chair, I think I'll just stick with Minnesota law for right now.
Any questions for Senator Prentner Solon on the bill?
Thank you.
Senator Lemmer.
Madam Chair and Senator Prentner Solon, I've heard some comments that, and maybe this was from the House discussion, but this doesn't mean that individual private homes, that someone might be conducting a garage sale in the driveway. Does that mean that individual has to open up their private residence for the use of a bathroom?
Madam Chair.
Senator Prentner Solon.
Senator Lemmer, I don't think so. I think it relates to retail merchants, and I'm not sure if that is that qualifies a home garage sale. I don't think so. They're not licensed or as such.
Okay. The only reason I was just wondering if page 2, line 1 and 2, I suppose, I don't know. I guess it's, let's just say for the record, retail establishment doesn't mean a private individual that's conducting a garage sale. And at least just
for
leave
the record,
it on the
but
written
I think, yeah.
or on the verbal record, oral record.
Senator Lumber, line 1.13 defines retail establishment.
Oh, okay.
And it means a place of business open to the general public for the sale of goods or services. A place of business. I think a garage sale wouldn't necessarily be considered a place of business. Right. So, Senator Betzel.
Apparently, I take it that the customer doesn't have to have anything more than just showing up and saying, oh, I've got an eligible medical condition, or I've got an irritable bowel syndrome or something like that. Just say those magic words and you get access to the bathroom.
Senator Partner-Solin, what would
out of chair, at one point there was a request that somebody have to produce a card, but there are a number of conditions such as pregnancy that may require some urgency. And it might be helpful to hear from Laurel Schwartz, who suffers from
Crohn's disease. Mm-hmm.
From Crohn's disease. And she could share what her experience has been.
Well, Ms. Schwartz, I appreciate that you're here today. And if you could, you know, keep it a little brief. We're sympathetic. I think the committee is not hostile to the idea. So, you know, help us move along because we have a number of bills.
In February, I spent 2 weeks in the hospital with a flare. I had recently gotten out of the hospital when I was at Blockbuster on Grand Avenue. When I was in the store, I had to go to the bathroom suddenly. I asked the clerk if I could use their restroom, and they told me that the restroom was for employees only. I knew that it was an emergency, and I couldn't wait until I got home. I had to literally run 2 blocks to get to the nearest restroom that was available for public use. Fortunately, I made it in time, but the situation was embarrassing and uncomfortable, and it certainly did not have to be. I was lucky I didn't have an accident, but I cannot be sure that I'll be lucky in the future.
Thank you. You know, I'm a mom with little kids. I don't think that's contemplated here, but boy, sprinting for 2 blocks, I've done that with a little kid in tow, you know. It's like an exercise. Any other questions for Senator Partner-Solin or Ms. Schwartz? Senator
Chair,
Foley?
Madam Chair, I'm looking at the bill itself, and it's defined as Restroom Access Act. And then it goes down on line 1.12, and it says toilet facility. And then on line 1.17, it says restroom facilities. And then on 1.21, employee toilet facilities again. It seems to me that they all are aiming at the same general purpose, and maybe one of those ought to be the surviving definition.
Senator Partner-Solin, restroom facility.
Madam Chair, I don't have any preference.
Senator Foley moves that wherever there is toilet facility, we insert restroom facility. All right, Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And Council will help us make that happen. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Senator Betzel.
I was just going to note that the bill has a title, which normally don't do, but it does say Restroom Access Act, so maybe we'll use the term restroom periodically. I just wondered if we should add irritable child syndrome in here, too. Do we adopt the A2 amendment?
No, we're going to. Okay. Do you want to move the A2 amendment?
I'll move the A2 amendment.
Senator Betts moves the A2 amendment. Any further discussions?
What is the A2 amendment about?
Senator Partner-Solin had explained it, but Senator Partner-Solin, can you explain it again?
Maybe? Actually, the amendment applies a simple negligence standard, and the language is a balance that protects both the patrons and the retailers. Liability language applies to almost all types of injury claims. The person bringing the claim must establish the burden of proof. And then also it reduces the fine for violation from $100 to $50.
And simple, Madam Chair and Senator.
Senator Lumber.
Simple negligence is what we're going toward, and what did we have before?
Senator Partner-Solin? Grossly negligent, yeah. Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, in that A2 amendment, there's a number of toilet facilities in there. Would you please?
Let the record reflect that Senator Foley's amendment also on restroom facility also pertains to the head note and the A2 amendment. That will be incorporated.
Thank you.
If adopted. On the A2 amendment, Senator Betzel has moved that. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. And then Senator Limmer moves. Senator Limmer? Yes. Senator Limmer moves that Senate File 140, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions? Anybody in the audience want to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Now you may go use the restroom, Senator Betzel.
Thank you.
Let's see. Senate File 2161.
Just thinking about it.
Yeah. Madam Chair and members, this
Don't
is a bill. This is a bill that was brought to me by the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors and is primarily a recodification and reorganization of the current platting statute. The sections of the bill that I believe are of interest to this committee are Section 2, Subdivision 3, which is on page 3, line 11, relates to ownership interest and acknowledgement. This subdivision clarifies what information must appear on the plat as it relates to ownership interest. It is important that all those with an interest in the property be properly acknowledged on the plat, and the language in this section outlines who that is and what sort of notarization is required. And then moving on.
Yes, please.
Subdivision 7, which is on page 4, line 17, relating to easements. This subdivision outlines what specific technical information relating to easements must be shown on a plat.
We're operating the first engrossment. I don't think the lines are.
Am I on a different?
Do you have the first engrossment, Senator Petner?
I thought I did. That's what I was working off of. Yes.
Do you have the first engrossment numbers?
Maybe. Oh, I'm sorry. I might be on the wrong one. I'm sorry.
We're on the wrong bill.
You're on the wrong bill. Yes.
It wasn't. You don't want to talk about the other bill? That's fine.
my fault. We didn't put in proper order.
Gotcha.
Okay. Senator Petner Solon.
Okay.
So, Subdivision 7, page
yes.
4, line 17.
Okay.
Easements.
And this subdivision outlines what specific technical information relating to easements must be shown on a plat, and that easements created on a plat are limited to public utility and drainage easements. It also states that temporary easements, building setback information, and building floor elevation shall not be shown. Moving on to Section 4, Real Estate Taxes, Recording and Copies, page 6, line 23. This section states that every plat has to be properly authorized, labeled, stored, and available to be inspected by the public, and that it must show the current year's taxes have been paid prior to the recording. The final section of interest to this committee is the repealer on the last page. This would be Section 505.08, Subdivision 3, Premature Reference to Plat and Forfeiture. And this subdivision imposed a penalty of $100 for each lot or part of a lot disposed of, leased, or offered before it was recorded, except that it does not apply to an offer to sell or lease a unit in a common interest community. The current penalty is $100 per month for each month that compliance is delayed. And this section is being deleted because it is bad law and stands in the way of commerce. It is not used or enforced and is violated all the time. This section was deleted at the request of the Minnesota State Bar Association Real Estate Section, and Kevin Dunleavy, who advocated its deletion, is available to comment on this section should members have any questions.
And then that's the bill. The provisions of the bills are in this committee, Senator Petner Solon.
That is it, Madam Chair.
It's been my experience that in recodifications, you know, we move things around, we add some things, we delete some things. In the previous sections that we've looked at, on page 3, page 4, and on page 6, can you tell us what's been added or what the changes is from current law, I guess?
I'm going to let my witness explain that, Madam Okay. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm Lynn Caswell,
past president of the Minnesota Society of Professional Surveyors. On page 3 in section 2, the area that was added reflects an issue that has happened sometimes where there's discrepancies in the name of the plat. This clarifies where the official name of the plat occurs, and that being in the dedication statement.
Okay.
Subdivision 3, there's always, hasn't been anything in the current statute that says who should sign a plat other than the owner. In the beginning of Subdivision 3, we've added the contract for deed vendees and mortgage holders. Page.
Senator Lummer.
Sir, on Subdivision 3, especially on lines 319 to 23, there's a reference of a certificate of a notary to sign. And why would there be a need for a notary on that document?
Mr. Caswell?
Madam Chair, it's been the pattern on platting that all signatures of individuals that are acknowledging the dedication of land and easement, that their signatures be notarized.
Mr. Caswell, is that current law, or is that new language, or is that current law moved from somewhere
I believe
else?
That is in current law. The only
moved
thing
from somewhere
that
else.
The only thing that we did in here is toward the end is we've had a problem with the notarial stamps in that the media that's used for the plat documents absorbs the ink and it just becomes a smudge. We spent a great deal of time debating this in our committee, and the actual notarial law does not require a stamp to be used if all of the information is on there, such as the name and the county and the date of expiration. So we would like the pattern to be that notarial stamps not be used, but...
Very good. Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Caswell, looking at page 2 and section 2, you have a lot of specificity in there on the content. Is there any need for that? It seems to me that with changing technology that might be what's today, but it might not be what's next week, next year.
Mr. Caswell?
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but I don't understand the question.
I think Senator Foley is referring to sections that's not in this committee.
This was changed.
But that's Subdivision 1, the platform.
Madam Chair, the main change in Section 2 and Subdivision 1 was the media size in the old plat was platting law, or the current platting law is 20 by 30 or 30 by 40, and which is a non-standard size sheet of paper. And we change the primary change in that is to go to a 22 by 34, which is a standard sheet size. And it's really to try to bring this up to current technology rather than technology some time ago.
Madam Chair,
Senator Foley.
I was just curious why you needed that. It seems to me that is...
Madam Chair, could I respond
Please.
To Senator Foley? My name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I'm the co-chair of the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the Bar Association. And the reason that the surveyors want this is because the county recorders around the state are using all different kinds of sizes. And so this will standardize the plat sizes throughout the state. And that's been a goal of the Bar Association for a number of years.
Any other questions on any other? Actually, my question on the subdivision 7, the easement section, what's the new language there? Or the entire section is new language? Mr. Caswell? Page 4, subdivision 7, easements, right?
the new, Madam Chair, the new language in there, basically are lines 421 and 422.
Okay.
We do have some issues with communities and counties wanting us to add easements and other lines on the record plat that do not deal with drainage or utilities.
Okay.
And we're trying to limit what is shown on these plats just so that they don't end up being used for other purposes other than dividing up land.
Very good. And then in section 4, what's the new language there?
Four.
Page 6. Mr. Caswell?
Madam Chair, there really is nothing new being done in this section other than it's being rewritten to be more understandable.
Very good. That's why we asked that question, Mr. Caswell. Mm-hmm. Any other questions for Senator Pertner Solon or the witnesses? Senator Limmer.
Madam Chair, I'd like to bring our attention to page 8. There's a nearly all of the requirement portion of this page has been stricken, and I see on page 8, lines 19 through 20, 21, maybe even going down to 23, it talks about members of the public having available copies to be made available to them, and at least in this reference, 50 cents a fee. Are we replacing this with new language that the public can have copies made available to them somewhere else in the bill?
That's right. Yeah. So, Caswell, is this language captured elsewhere in the bill? It looks to me like it might have just be a removal and placed elsewhere, but is that specific issue captured somewhere else in the bill?
Madam Chair, I'm just trying to find the section in here. It's
page 8. Line 8.19 and 8.20 and 8.21.
Senator Moa, well, he's looking for that. Could I address part of the
yes.
question? Senator Limmer, the fees charged by the county recorder were negotiated, I think, in the last session, a session before, to try to make them all standard throughout the state. And so the fee part of it would be included in that legislation. Previously, I think the charge would now be $10 rather than 50 cents.
Madam Chair,
Senator Limmer.
I don't remember that discussion from last year, but how big of a piece of paper would that official plat be?
20 by 30.
Either the witness, Mr. Cashwell.
Usually when I get copies of plats, it's on blueprint size paper.
Uh-huh.
It's like 2 feet by 3 feet. Depends on whether you get it from the surveyor's office or the county recorder's office.
I see. The question I have is that would that represent the actual cost to the person requesting it? Is that an actual cost, or is there any additions to that?
The $10 fee?
Yeah.
That's probably less than what it costs the county. I mean, the county probably, it probably doesn't cost the county much at all to do the actual printing. So the county probably makes a little bit of money on that.
Madam Chair, we have other references in data practice law that makes it available for the public to have documents printed by government or at the request to government officials, but it's supposed to represent closely the cost. It's not supposed to be a profit-making venture. And I just want to make sure we emphasize that, because we really don't want, I think it's been the practice of our committees and state government to recognize that we want to keep the cost as low as possible to any government document, so that the public has as much opportunity to learn about what government is doing for or maybe to them, and that I try to emphasize that every conversation we have on fees and government documents. I had another question on this, and I
Madam Chair, on that point, though.
Senator Olson.
Madam Chair, Senator Limmer. Senator Limmer and I are in accord in terms of our concern about copying costs, and we've had this discussion with respect to other things in data practices. But that being said, I guess I think your answer just reflected the cost of actually the reproduction cost of copying this record. And when we've heard testimony on copying of records from other departments or in other contexts, they've included the cost of going and retrieving the record and paying someone to go through the process, and so they're looking at much more than just the cost of reproduction. In this situation, I think most of the time people are just going to be requesting one copy of one record, and so $10 is probably the only cost they're going to pay. Where in practice, what becomes really onerous is when you have hundreds of pages that someone's requesting, and the bill can become hundreds of dollars when you're charged $1 a page, you know, in those situations. So I guess I have to say, Senator Limmer, that this seems fairly reasonable to me when you look at the cost of going and retrieving the record and adding and putting all of that in there when we're just talking about one record.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
My experience has been, is at least with a developer who may be looking at a section of land that wants to, let's say, find the owners, and they want to perhaps ask three owners the opportunity to determine whether or not they want to sell. And if they can get all three together, it might be a good buy for all parties concerned. Now, how does that apply to this? Well, if you have a clerk behind a counter in some government office, I recognize the cost factor of labor, but I also recognize that the clerk is there to provide a service to the public in the first place, and they're supposed to be there to shuffle around and find information and documentation. If an individual is being charged $10 for a piece of paper, large piece of paper, they may have to go back to some archive file, pull up a large binder, and then pull out the appropriate map. Now, if that particular developer needed three contiguous maps that represented land that were contiguous to one another, they probably can find it in the same bundle of that particular section in a county office. And so the workload... is it appropriate to spend $30 for three pieces of paper when the person only makes one trip to the binder? We can go on forever on this type of logic, but I keep trying to emphasize that it's not so much for the purposes of this, but I don't know how we manage all of this from this table. I just don't know if we can, but I think we have to emphasize that the cost should always be as close to the actual cost as possible.
Mr. Caswell.
Madam Chair, the answer to your question is found on the bottom of page 7, where...
Starting at line 29, Senator Limmer.
Yes.
I see.
But the cost isn't specified. I'm assuming that that's just... the counties sort of set that. We didn't set that in statute.
Right. So. The counties, every county charges different fees for pages, or for sheets, or copies, for plats.
Madam Chair.
Senator Limmer.
I just had I don't get this type of a witness before me, and I have another issue that I'm working on. I just wanted to ask one question.
No. On the bill, Senator Limmer.
I'll talk to him later.
All right. Thank you, Senator Limmer. Any other questions to the witnesses of Senator Partner Solon on what's before us in this committee and the bill? Anybody else in the audience want to testify for or against this bill?
I would move the bill.
Senator Foley moves that Senate File 2161 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members.
Senator Pappas is on her way for Senate file 1533. Why don't we have your witness, her witnesses come to the table?
We've been waiting.
No, you came
no,
just
No, we just finished.
Madam Chair, I don't know what made me think I had time to go to the bank. I apologize. Madam Chair, in 2004, the Department of Commerce and the Attorney General proposed a law to curb the practice of equity stripping, otherwise known as foreclosure rescue schemes. This has been a model law which has been replicated in other states, and it did drive the worst offenders out of business, allowing legitimate transactions to go forward, and gave homeowners the tool to combat those remaining unscrupulous industry actors. But the scammers found a loophole, and what this bill does is close that loophole and make other needed changes to the 2004 law.
Ms. Elwood, are you going to walk us through the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood, Legal Aid. Yes, I would like to do that briefly. The bill, this bill actually, just a preliminary statement, comes to us from an entity known as the Equity Stripping Task Force, which was actually put into place before the statute was enacted in 2004. It consists of members of the private bar, legal aid, and attorney general, and it was convened under the auspices of the Volunteer Lawyer Network. These are folks, attorneys who were working and continue to work on these types of mortgage foreclosure rescue scam cases. And the experience that this group has had since the enactment of the 2004 law has led to this bill coming before you today. So I just want to give you context. The bill does five major things, and if we turn to page 3, lines 3.9 through 3.10. This is the major provision of the bill. The statute in 2004 was trying to curb the practice where an investor, as they're known, or foreclosure purchaser, when the homeowner's at the end of their rope and there's nothing left, they come and say, we'll save your home. You deed your property to us, and we will then lease it back to you or do a contract for deed or some other sort of lease back kind of arrangement. So what happens is the homeowner becomes the tenant, a tenant of the purchaser. But the law only covered the residents in foreclosure. In the intervening years between the time the statute was enacted and today, some of these scammers figured out a way around that. They would say to the homeowner, well, I can't put you back in your own home, but I happen to have this other property over on this street or over here, and they would do exactly the same deal but in a different house. And that is not covered because only the residence in foreclosure is the residence that triggers all the protections. So what this provision here on page 3 does is bring in any other residence in which the foreclosure purchaser or an affiliate has an interest. And that closes the big loophole which we were here to close. And while we were at it, we figured we'd do a couple of other things. And the next major change, it's really a clarification, is on page 7, lines 7.6 through 7.8. And what that does, there was some confusion when the bill was originally drafted. The definition of who a foreclosure purchaser is in the original statute is someone who does two of these transactions within a 24-month period. Well, the situation arose where somebody had done one, so if you did one, you really weren't covered. But then you did the second one, and then the question arises, well, was the first one covered, or is that a free bite at the apple, or not? Were you a foreclosure purchaser when you did the first one, or not? And what the real intent of this statute originally was is to say, look, if you're actually in the business of doing this, and you're not trying to help a friend or a relative or somebody else, you know, that's who we were after. And I think the language that we have now in the amendment makes that absolutely clear. You are not a foreclosure purchaser. You are not covered by the statute. If you are not in the business of doing this and you have some kind of a relationship with the homeowner. So essentially, if you're just trying to help somebody out, you're not subject to the law. The third thing we do is later on in that page, lines 7.12 to 7.16, and it just makes it a little clearer on what a residence in foreclosure is. It, you know, these folks, we wanted to make sure that everybody was covered, because once people get into default, that's when these letters come, the phone calls come, the solicitations come. And we wanted to make sure that it was broad enough so that once these folks came to the door, they were covered. And that's what this provision on page 7 does. The second to the – no, I guess – let's see. Yeah, the last item that really is of great importance in this bill is on page 12. And continuing on to page 13, that whole new section there on the stay of eviction action provisions. The problem that the lawyers have encountered is because the former homeowner now is a tenant, when the deals are structured to actually rip the folks off, they structure the deal so they couldn't make the home payments, but neither can they make the rent payments. And now that the foreclosure purchaser is the homeowner's got the deed, they simply have to evict the homeowner to steal the house and the equity. And when we would make a claim that there's been a violation of the new statute, the housing court referees would say, that's a district court matter. This is well beyond our jurisdiction. The question before us is, did you pay the rent? Did you not pay the rent? The answer, of course, was no. You're out. And so the situation would occur then where the client would be displaced from the home, and if later on, when they prevailed in district court and the transaction was unwound, they would be, of course, placed back in the home. But by that time, either they've suffered hardship or worse, the foreclosure purchaser got rid of the house and there's no house to go back to. So what this provision does is to say that upon a prima facie showing that there is a claim under 325N and some basic threshold matters have been met, the referee will simply stay the eviction action until the 325N, the foreclosure rescue provisions, are adjudicated in district court. And I can say to you that in our experience, I don't believe we've had one instance where the client has not prevailed in the 325 action. And, Madam Chair, members, that's basically the walkthrough of the bill. If you have any questions, happy to answer it.
Any questions for Senator Pappas or Ms. Elwood?
If there's no one in the audience, Madam Chair.
Anybody in the audience here to testify for or against this bill?
I would move adoption.
Senator Foley moves that Senate File 1533 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails.
Hey, Madam Chair.
We are stand in recess.
I have a meeting upstairs at 1:30, so I'm going to be a little late in getting back here. I have to talk to the front office about my conference committee.
How long do you think
since I had a negative target, I hope it doesn't take too long.
Here, how is that? The committee is in recess. I didn't put a stated time.
Yeah.
But